if I speak to everyone who I know that's interesting, even accounting for meeting new people, then one per week I'll probably be done in about 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, you'd be here for a while.
And then if I ever run out of people, I'll just start again. And then those people will be 8 years difference or 6 years difference. Maybe we'll listen to what we've talked about 6 years prior and then pick up the discussion in time.
Yeah. So my name's Pat Armstrong. I guess I'm a web designer mostly. That's mostly what I tell people. And most of what I do day to day in my job.
Design webs.
Yeah, design webs. Mostly for museums and art galleries and cultural institutions, I guess. That's my sort of main overlap of things I'm interested in and things that people will pay me to do. I'm sort of interested in other stuff, but only sort of hobby-level interests that I can't figure out. Well, they're not at the level that people would pay me for.
Like your interest in it or your skill at it?
Or the current market demand? Well, probably skill at it and current market demand.
Yeah, right.
Like, every now and again, I have this idea that I want to do a master's in urban planning or something like that and think about how cities and parts of them work and interact with each other. But then I realize that I'd probably just end up designing roundabouts or working for a local council, or maybe you get lucky and you get a job with some amazing urban design studio and you sort of design a plan for a walkable city that's to be implemented over the course of 20 years and then gets given to a council who give it to a state government who put it out to tender, who get a low bidder and sort of botch the whole thing, and then there's a change of government, and then, yeah, I imagine it would be working on projects that are that size and that time scale would be pretty frustrating. Or you'd just be designing roundabouts.
Or you can design Canberra and do both.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually, I've had, we were talking before about comics journalism, there was a, on my list of things to read, is a really long piece of comics journalism about the design and planning and implementation of Canberra as a city. And how that was designed by, what's his name, Walter Burley Griffin?
Yeah.
Who, his training and background apparently was very much about grids and regularity and, you know, the sort of north, south, east, west kind of logical, sensible, gridded city. And for whatever reason, he'd sort of chosen to reject that in the design of Canberra, for better or for worse. And there's all these amazing watercolours that I've only seen little snatches of this kind of scheme for Canberra that makes it look like, you know, that they produced, that makes it look like this kind of amazing sort of levitating city that just kind of hovers above the land. Yeah, that sort of stuff is all really fun and interesting to me to look at sort of casually, but I can't imagine how it would be, how to make it a sustainable and interesting job.
So is the implementation of desires for how things will look and feel and interact, is that just easier when it's on the web?
Well, I guess it's
to implement,
it's a smaller scale. Even big web projects are sort of, you can draw a box around them and they're sort of self-contained. The speed at which you can go from having an idea to making a thing real on the internet is much faster. You know, there's, even when you work with organizations that have their own internal processes and bureaucracies and things for approval, it's still easy, relatively easy and quick to go from idea to finished thing. And then if you put the finished thing out in the world and you realize that people aren't using it the way you wanted them to, then, or, you know, the way you expected them to, or the way that you designed it to, you can easily monitor that. You can get in there and you can make a change. So the responsiveness and the sort of reactiveness of it. I mean, my background, my training's in print design, like books and magazines. Yeah. And I really wanted to get into publishing and books when I came out of uni, but kind of the bottom fell out of that market while I was finishing my degree.
Great.
And for a while I was sort of, and I still am a little bit, you know, I really love print and books and collecting books and working on print projects whenever I can, because at the end of the process you have a physical, tangible thing that you can hold in your hands, but you don't really get that with, you don't get that with the web and with digital work as much. But I think the trade-off is that you get to do more exciting and interesting things, especially, you know, over the last couple of years. There was sort of a tipping point for me maybe about three, four years ago, I guess, when the exciting things you could do online became more interesting to me than the exciting things you could do in print, at least in terms of the work that I was doing day to day.
Yeah. The things that really excite me when you're working with dynamic systems is that you can, they can reference and leverage content that just wasn't around when you sent something to print, for example.
Yeah, totally.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think that.
But I sometimes, I don't know, like, romantic, I think it's easier to see this, say, in music media than in printed media. But the romanticization of the record, and then the romanticization of the cassette, and the romanticization of the CD, and that they're all just mediums for holding things. And that the book also just being a medium for holding something, and it still not being an actual tangible thing. You still can't touch it. We have an illusion or a relationship to books that they are objects, but actually they're still just a medium for,
like a vehicle for information, transmission.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's true.
But it's not our relationship with them.
No. And there's plenty of books that I have that I, books that I have, books that I've collected. I collected Pelican paperbacks for quite a long time. Pelican is an imprint, a kind of non-fiction sort of science and psychology and sociology imprint of Penguin books. And they, in the 50s and 60s or so, they, instead of commissioning cover art from artists or using artworks, they, or even just illustrators really, they commissioned a bunch of mostly Italian graphic designers to do these kind of wild abstract patterns on them, and their books on, yeah, the ones that I have, their books on psychology, on sociology, on finance, on raising children, on sort of big sort of international social movements, that sort of thing. I think I've read two of them, and the rest of them, the other sort of 40 or 50, I just have for their amazing covers and the sort of theme of them as an object. So that's, I guess, the one extreme of relating to a book as a, as an object rather than as a vehicle for transmission of stuff. But I guess lately I've been buying, like, I still buy and love large coffee table art books and sort of books that have been printed really nicely, bound really nicely. They've been designed with consideration of them as a, as an object, and, you know, the way that you would move through them, either kind of reading them page by page or flipping through them, or but I've found that I've been buying, it started with sort of work related books, so books about HTML, books about CSS, JavaScript, all of that stuff. I found that I was happy to read that sort of stuff on a screen because it was related to work and my work was all on a screen, but that reading for fun, I still wanted to read on paper. But lately I've found that I've been buying theory and philosophy books and books that don't depend on being presented nicely to actually be interesting. I've been buying those as ebooks, and I guess at some point, probably reading things off a phone screen for so long, I've just become used to getting content off a screen without sort of feeling like it's work.
E-ink, though, it feels very different to me.
I can't get my head around it. I tried to. I had a Kindle. Like the newest, not the newest new one. The one that's a generation before the one they're currently selling. which...
Paperwhite or something?
Yeah, that's it.
Because I just got a Kobo, which is their direct competitor.
Mm.
Same. Everything's basically same.
Mm.
Except the infrastructure behind it.
Mm. Like the means of buying and loading on ebooks and that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, right.
But the device themselves are the same.
Mm.
It's like a very... Do you mean you're trying to get your head around being comfortable with it or with the technology?
The technology is fine. I mean, I kind of like it. Every 6 months or so, I Google e-ink smartphone to see if someone's actually made one that I want to use.
Yeah, there's cases.
Yeah, but that's... The reason I want an e-ink smartphone is I want a phone that does all the interesting... Well, some of the interesting stuff that a smartphone does, but it's not...
LCD.
Yeah, well, not LCD, but also, like, a magnet for sucking up your time. I've made my phone as boring as I can. Like, I've taken all of the social media off it. If you go into the parental controls on iOS, you can turn off Safari, so you can't browse the web anymore. I mean, you can go back in and turn it on, but you have to go into the settings and put in a 4-digit code, and then all of a sudden...
Just friction.
Yeah.
Creating some friction.
Yeah, to make you think about what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah, that was my New Year's resolution, was that my phone never enters the bedroom. So I set up a charging station and such in the lounge room, and now there's a place that it belongs. It doesn't enter the bedroom. I don't read it as I go to sleep, whatever.
Yeah, I tried to set a rule of no screens in bed.
I don't think e-ink counts.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Because it's not, especially if it's not backlit.
Yeah, that's my main opposition to them, is backlighting screens. They're going to, I saw that Apple are going to, in the next iOS update, they're releasing a thing that's kind of like that Flux software.
Yeah, I read about that.
It'll make your phone go a bit more orange at night to save your eyeballs.
But
I don't know. I've actually, despite all this talk about screens and backlighting and stuff, I've never actually had trouble sleeping.
No, same. Me neither.
Regardless of what I've been looking at.
Do you think that's a future for a lot of people? This, like...
Reading things off screens?
Well, or starting to put friction in between things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We're heading towards less friction between us and information.
Mm.
And there's a project that I'm proposing at the moment that involves dance performance and augmented reality vision, purely because I think the biggest cultural shift, and I got this from listening to that Review the Future podcast, will be that at the moment we share visual space with the people that are around us.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are existing in augmented reality future, we won't be sharing visual space anymore. And even though we're together, we won't be together visually.
Mm.
And what impact is that going to have? And
I don't know. Whenever there's conversations about sort of technology making us narrow down into...
Individualism.
And you know, not paying attention to anyone. And, you know, there's photos of everyone sitting on the train looking at their smartphones and stuff. There's a great newspaper cartoon from the 1920s, which I always have trouble finding, and I really should just save on my computer because I seem to go back to it 2 or 3 times a year, I think it's from the 1920s, of a whole bunch of people sitting on the train with their broadsheet newspapers up in front of their face, looking at each other. And you go back to any kind of new technology, and there's always accusations of it sort of making us more sort of narrow-minded and individual-focused, I guess, which I don't... I mean, you can do that with it, sure, but I think blaming the technology is kind of the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I
just wonder what it's going to be like if we're sitting here and we look up at that wall and you see the things that you've hung on that wall and I see the things that I want to be on that wall, even though it's in your house. and we're not looking at the same thing anymore. Because at least if we're both looking up and around from whatever handheld information medium we have, that's different.
Yeah, or if we're looking at a screen even that has some digital stuff on it, that's the same shared experience.
Yeah.
I don't know, I mean...
Well, I could just give you really long dreadlocks or something. Every time I see you...
You could change it to hairstyle.
You have dreadlocks.
Yeah, right.
And so you're not in control of your own image, even in the real world. I mean, that doesn't bother me so much. I'm just interested in, I guess, where you think, because what we've been doing about so far is like IRL design and implementation, and then web design and implementation, and augmented reality seems to be things where these are going to augment.
I mean, I guess there's that's actually a conversation that I've been seeing a bit more of online. I haven't really been engaging with it too much, but I know that it's there, is this idea of, you know, you sort of saw it happen with print design. It went from, you know, laying out a printed page and, you know, it's got text and photographs on it and it needs to be printed. That used to be, you know, there used to be the photo retoucher, the guy who built the line of type, the compositor who put it all together, you know, passed through several people's hands with the printers. You know, it used to be a kind of 20 or 30 person job to lay out and produce a short magazine or booklet. And that suddenly became a thing that you could do. You know, there'd be one person who would work at home on desktop publishing software and do it themselves, and they'd take it to a print shop and it would all be abstracted into a sort of digital printing machine, and there'd just be one operator who would run that. So, and you started to see it with web design. It's kind of collapsed down onto itself a little bit. You know, what used to be a very sort of niche specialist field, all of a sudden, like, you can pay sort of $10 a month and get a pretty good Squarespace theme or pro WordPress thing or whatever. Yeah. And for most people, most of the time, that's more than enough. You know, they can, if you're a photographer or a performer or someone who just needs a little folio site, it doesn't need to be different from everyone else's, it just needs to showcase the work. You can do that. And so sort of small, like, what used to be the bread and butter of small web design businesses has slowly been disappearing. And then at the other end, you get kind of banks and large companies that are wholesale buying up sort of user experience and design research studios and sort of bringing them in-house to use as their own agencies. Like, there's a group in the US called Adaptive Path, which I think it was sort of one of the early sort of pioneers of user experience as a design concept. And, you know, this idea that you should think about what the user needs rather than just, you know, what looks good. Anyway, I think they got bought by, I forget which bank, but they're basically the design department of a large American bank now. So there's this idea that, and then I guess also, you know, platforms like articles on Facebook, like medium.com, where all the design is taken care of for you, you can sort of see the, like, there's less room for designers in how the web works.
Yeah.
And people are thinking about, you know, what would it be like to design for an Oculus Rift or for virtual reality or, you know.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what it would be like to choreograph on those platforms. So that people still come together to experience something shared, and these things are part of that. So I think they will be.
Yeah, I think it's like it'd be one of those things where I think it's going to be hard for any of us who have grown up in the world before these things existed to really imagine how they'll be used. I think it's probably, realistically, it's up to people who are going to grow up with them as kind of native things to really wrap their heads around. Like, there's a really, I was talking about this with someone the other day, there's a good Douglas Adams quote that I'm going to botch, which is something like, any technology that's invented before you're born is perfectly natural in the way of the world. Anything that's invented between, you know, age 10 to age 30 or 40 is new and exciting, and you can probably get a career in it. And anything that's invented after you're 30 or 40 is sort of evil and not to be trusted. And that seems to sort of hold true for everyone. Like, I wonder a lot about, like, I haven't been doing it lately, but I used to teach at university, so web design and programming for designers, pretty much. and this idea of a whole generation of kids growing up with YouTube on all the time, and this idea that you can instantly retrieve any piece of media that you want, more or less, is that sort of does my head in ways that I don't really quite understand. But yeah, the idea of, and I guess on designing a thing, designing, you know, an experience or a performance or whatever for a sort of shared experience is a kind of weird question. Not a weird question, but something that I've noticed, and this has come up from talking to other people who've been teaching in design as well, especially people who engage with pop culture stuff, so talking about animation, about film, about comics, is that with young people these days, there's sort of less and less of this kind of shared pop culture canon. Like, everyone's into their own little weird niche and subgenre, which I think is why when things like, say, the new Star Wars comes out, everyone flips out because it's one of the last sort of massive pop culture things. Or when someone like David Bowie dies, they're kind of sort of on the edge of, you know, some of the last kind of big monolithic bits of shared culture that a lot of people have. Whereas sort of these days with, you know, the internet is very good at forming sort of subcultures and small groups that can have their own, you know, things to get excited about, and they kind of build these things on their own rather than getting them from mass media. And, you know, the mass media itself becomes more and more fractured as you go along, I guess.
Well, I wonder if mass media is just at the other end of its bell curve, and there was a time before it where things were more region specific, and this is the time after it, or we're moving into the time post mass media, but still within globalization.
Yeah, it's hard to really.
So your regional communities are not geographically specific.
Yeah, like there's sort of subcultures around, I don't know, particular kind of music or aesthetics or whatever. Yeah. And I guess a lot of them do have sort of geographic bases still, but yeah, it's sort of interesting to see things fracture and split a bit more.
Yeah. Well, this always happens with live performance as well, and dance especially. People, there'll be 40 to 400 people watching the same thing, but then they'll all leave having different opinions of it because they didn't get to just go to the next YouTube when that specific thing they've been given was boring or whatever. And what would it be to have all those people there that could, like, see the thing the way that they wanted, the aesthetic that they wanted, and the space or the dances or whatever are just the basis thread for everybody to still have their individual experience. But maybe that's not the big question. I mean, I'm interested in what you think are the questions around considering the future that people are not yet asking, because I think a lot of the discussions that people have are already old.
Yeah. Like, I feel like I've had the same conversation about, like, self-driving cars a couple of times this year already.
And yeah.
It's
only 3 weeks in.
Yeah.
What is that conversation? Wrap it up.
You know, that
it'll happen.
It'll happen, and no one's going to own a car anymore, and what's going to happen to parking garages, and what's going to happen to taxis, and what's going to happen to Uber, and what's going to happen to truck drivers. That's an interesting one, but that's kind of been covered. Like, truck driving is one of the last sort of unskilled blue collar professions that you can still.
Well, blue singlet, mate.
All right,
blue singlet profession. Whenever I've driven a truck, I'm in a blue singlet.
But it's one of the last things that you can sort of arguably, you know, support.
Yes.
Support a family on. Yep. And pay as a decent income.
Yeah.
Without huge amounts of training.
Yeah.
And once, you know, I imagine there's probably more money in, you know, proportionally more money going into self-driving trucks than there is self-driving cars, because if you can get freight moving around with no people in it,
it's going to be amazing.
mining trucks moving around with no people in them, then yes, it'll be amazing for the company, but it's a whole stack of people out of work through no fault of their own. So
yeah,
that'll be interesting.
I mean, I in my ignorance and privilege liken it to, say, the automation and depopulating of mine sites where you used to have people with picks and shovels underground dying, and now we've got explosives and digging machines, and that's put a lot of people out of work, and it's rough, but they shouldn't actually be there in the first place.
Yeah, right.
And of course, that's speaking from a position where I haven't, like, I'm not going hungry, I don't have children to feed. If I need to reskill, then fall back on.
You haven't been put out of work by a piece of technology.
In a way, I have, because I think live performance is quite under the thumb of mediated, broadcasted
entertainment. Yeah, right. Okay, you know.
And there are many, many small to medium venues around the inner west that have been turned into apartments that would have three generations ago
supported
a lot, like shows each night of the week, for example. I go to, but yeah, I don't know. That's what I think about anyway. When I think about jobs disappearing, I kind of hope that they're the sort of jobs that we shouldn't have people doing in the first place.
Yeah. There's a book that I'm reading. I think it's called Inventing the Future. I'm only like 50 pages into it, so I can't really speak to it in any sort of serious capacity. But it's kind of loosely about the sort of the rise of automation and people being put out of work by machines, coupled with this idea of a kind of universal basic income.
Yeah.
That when a large swathe of the population gets put out of work through things that are out of their control and are no fault of their own, and not only do they become unemployed, but they become more or less unemployable because those kinds of jobs don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Then how do we keep everything ticking along?
Yeah.
And that kind of universal basic income idea is interesting. I haven't read enough about it to really talk too much about it. I mean, I'm a little bit suspicious of the whole concept. It kind of feels a little bit like when sort of early machines are introduced, there's this idea that everyone was going to be able to live a life of leisure and the machines would do all the work. And of course, it just meant that a couple of people got very rich and a lot of other people worked very hard for very little money.
The Luddites.
Yeah.
And then went and kicked the machines. The lathes and the spinning wheels and the weaving machines.
Yeah, so this, I don't know, this idea that full automation is going to perhaps sort of send us into a world of sort of utopian world of no menial labour.
Yeah, well,
I'm a bit suspicious of.
I think that we're going to end up with more menial labour, but for the sake of our happiness and fulfilment. Because I think most of us derive our value from our work. And just because we don't have to work doesn't mean we don't want to work. And we will create things to keep us fulfilled and happy and striving and working, even though those things won't have any tangible impact on our ability to eat or stay warm.
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. I mean,
know that's what games are.
Yeah, games and hobbies and things that you do. Like, I've started gardening because I wanted a thing to do that wasn't, you know, some work to do that wasn't looking at a screen.
Yeah.
And all I do is move pot plants around the house. And occasionally put my hands in bags of potting soil and fertilizer and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's absolutely no tangible outcome of that. You know, I would argue that it's a slight increase in mental well-being to have plants and green things around you when you live and work, but you know it's hard to measure that in.
Yeah,
you wouldn't want to give a dollar value to that.
No, you wouldn't want to. Okay, so those are the conversations that people are already having.
Yeah.
That are kind of done, mostly. Mm. What are the conversations that we're not yet having?
These are difficult things to try and think about. Because it's very hard to talk about anything new without framing it around things that you already know about.
Yes.
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are sort of conversations that I'd like to have more of that aren't being sort of things that aren't being talked about enough. Like with this idea of, you know, back to sort of full automation and universal income and stuff, the thing that seems to be missing from all of those conversations is that, like, you can usually pay a human somewhere else to do the work for less money than your machine costs. And I feel like that hasn't really been factored into the equations of, you know, this amazing utopia that we're all going to be living in. Is that if a company can get a sort of warehouse full of people in Bangladesh to do the same work for less than it would cost to set up and run the machines, then we're still not going to be in a world of amazing full automation, I guess. And then I guess there's also the question about like going back to sort of design. People do talk about this, but not as much as I really would like them to, I guess. And this is not really a new question, but I think it kind of becomes a more important question. Is that in design school and in sort of the design, you know, when you go out into the world and work as a designer, you get trained as and kind of cast as a problem solver. You know, a business has a problem, you sort of go in there, you do research, you do interviews, you propose some solutions to the problem, and then you implement them. You know, it's often a question of branding or of tone of voice or of how to raise more revenue for this company or whatever. But there's almost no training in design school or in the kind of broader discourse around design about actually like interrogating those problems, I guess. So is it actually the right question to ask? Are you actually doing the right job? To sort of, I mean, it's difficult because it's the way people earn their living, and if you start asking too many questions of the people who are writing your paychecks, they may stop writing them for you. But there's sort of, I feel like there's scope for people who work in design to be a bit more critical about the role they play in, you know, the processes that they end up in.
Isn't there something like, and like if you're an architect, there's an oath that you take, or I read that there was an oath, and maybe it's not applicable in Australia, but it's something to do with your employer that's commissioned you to design something for them and their corporation. They are your second client after the public, because the public, the general public, you're building something in their space and their visual space, and so
you have to first work for them.
Foremost, you should be working to the betterment of the civilians and civilization, the people in society. And I wonder if there's something like that with all design. The question, like, before you discuss how you can increase revenue of a pimp because he should be wearing a purple coat instead of a green one or something, like, maybe you should be discussing with him that there are other ways of income, or that's not your job, or is this what you mean? Like, reconsidering whether the question should be asked or whether there's a question of that being the important thing. How do you train for that, or how do you give people the mental constructs and skills to,
I mean, usually, like, it sort of seems a little bit, maybe a bit obvious to say, but the thing that makes the most sense for me, as far as all that goes, is being involved in the process as early as possible.
Yeah.
Rather than just getting a call and saying, hey, the sort of extreme example is, hey, we've got a little box on our website that we need you to design a little widget for. Can you do that? And it's sort of...
Because we're only at 10% conversion and we need 90% conversion to get the company going or something.
Yeah, so you're dropped into the sort of parameters of the problem have already been defined.
Yeah.
And I read a book a little while ago now by a guy named Dan Hill, who's done a variety of different design jobs. He was involved with Monocle magazine at some point, but has also done, like, he worked for Arup for a while. They're a big sort of engineering consultancy, do work all around the world. And I think, God, I forget the country he's in now, but it's essentially a kind of in-government design department in one of the Scandinavian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the outcomes that they design are actually kind of designed for sort of, you know, they do sort of policy design basically, and mm-hmm. sort of social things, like, you know, one of the examples I think in the book is that, you know, if you're thinking about, say, improving the overall health and well-being of a population, you'd normally go to, you know, campaigns and work about food and about diets, about exercise, about getting active, but you wouldn't necessarily think about, say, architecture and the way a city is planned. But if you design a city such that, you know, there's a bunch of interesting things within walkable distance, you don't have to get in your car to go anywhere, you know, that sort of thing, that has an outcome, that has an effect on people's health. And there's a bunch of examples in this book of his that I'd read, that are about sort of designing the way that people engage in just everyday stuff in their lives, but almost the only people who are able to actually do that are people at a kind of government, you know, sort of city, state, national level. Because if you're, you know, if you've been hired by a business client, ultimately their goal at the end of the day is to increase their own revenue.
Yeah.
And if it has a positive side effect of getting more people to recycle or getting, you know, more people to walk to work or whatever, then sure, great. But ultimately, a business is responsible to its shareholders, so that's
that's what they've got to do. Profit versus non-profit line, really, in the sand is we all have these mission statements of changing the world for better or for worse, but yeah, which one is compromised, the profit or the mission?
Yeah, sure.
The interesting thing about cheaper manufacturing happening not from completely automated machines in developed nations, but from cheaper labor in developing nations, is maybe that when the Industrial Revolution happened, and maybe it's still happening, and maybe that's what it means to be a developing nation, that you're going through an Industrial Revolution. But they're doing it with different technology. When each country or nation or region goes through that, so the people that are making all of the clothing in Bangladesh, for example, are working in tandem with quite sophisticated sewing machinery that would not have been available, say, to when most of our clothing was coming from Korea, or before that when most of it was coming from Japan, or before that when it was coming out of, I don't know, different European countries or American sweatshops or something like that. So I wonder if the machines, the real, like, mechanized assisted utopia is actually about cheap labor working in tandem with robots. Can it work in tandem with robots? Yeah, it's completely crap. But I wonder if that's just the that's how things happen, is that it is not the latest, most groundbreaking in our terms of conception of how much assistance a robot needs to make something happen for us that is really spreading and raising life standards around the world. It's actually like once an invention has become cheap enough to be beyond wonder, and we team that up with skilled or unskilled labor, then there it can increase further. I don't know, because in each situation it seems like a couple of generations have really shitty lives, and then at some point it starts turning around because all the money that has flowed into that country from developed nations has pushed that country towards being a developed nation, for better or for worse.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know enough about the sort of the dynamics of all of that to really make any serious comment on it. Like, yes, there's money going into those places, but also the amount of the sort of global share of who's got money seems to be skewing exponentially towards, what was the statistic the other day, that like there's like 6 people or 9 people or something have as much, the 9 richest people in the world have as much money as the like 3.5 billion poorest or something like that, not so number like that, which makes me wonder that, like, you know, what you've just described is, has been the model for a long time, but and that works really well if you're towards the top of the pile, but possibly really badly if you're anywhere towards the bottom of the pile.
One interesting thing I heard that's happening though in places like Bangladesh is because a lot of these jobs are going to women, suddenly these hugely patriarchal societies, women have income, and that's really altering the social dynamic of who has authority in a household situation.
Interesting side.
Also, for better or for worse. Also, and I don't know where this is from, I'll try and find it. The apparently, if you earn above like 15 or 20 grand a year, you're in the top 1%. And if you earn less than that, like from 5 to 15, you're in the top 10% of the world's wealthy people. So sometimes it feels like to me, if I have a fridge and it's full of food, I'm in the top 1%.
Yeah. As far as things go,
just as far as things go, Okay, well, that sounds like a great discussion. I feel like, hi, I'm here to solve this problem that you've laid out, but there is some bigger, broader thinking that could be done, like a few steps before we get to that problem.
Yeah, and that's kind of, that's a difficult thing to try and do.
Yeah.
I think, which is kind of why it seems to land on kind of governments and sort of organizations that have the kind of size and authority to kind of ask those questions. Like if you're just working in a small web design shop and, you know, someone says, can you redesign my small business website? Then you can't actually go in there and pull apart capitalism.
But
the kind of that question of how and if you can reframe the kind of design work, and not just, you know, graphic design is its own particular trade, but this idea of, you know, this idea of design is, you know, sort of broadening it out to sort of strategy and problem solving and that sort of thing, which seems to be happening especially in at the sort of higher end of things, how you can kind of reframe that work is I think an interesting question that'll could get more interesting over the next couple of years.
I'm interested in what further thoughts you have from the talk that I saw you give at Underbelly.
Oh, the one about the Amazon button.
Yeah.
I found out a day or two after I gave that talk that Amazon, so they, you know, it was kind of kind of converging a few different ideas, I guess. So this, like, you know, Amazon have released this button that you can, like, it's a physical hardware button you can install into your house. It's on Wi-Fi. You know, it's got a logo on it. You press the button and a box of whatever that thing is, dishwashing powder, toilet paper, instant coffee, whatever else, you know, sort of regular commodity that you need more of frequently, will be shipped to your house the next day. And then this separate thing they've done where they've been investigating, people thought it was an April Fool's joke, but it was actually the real deal, deliveries by drone. And I found out, you know, the week after, you know, a couple of days after I gave that talk, that they'd actually applied to the Federal Aviation Authority for a slice of airspace to be carved out specifically drone for drone space. Deliveries. Yeah.
Right.
So this idea that, you know, they'd kind of done this wacky drone delivery promo video.
Yeah.
It kind of, the audience for that wasn't really you and me who thought we might one day get a thing delivered by drones, but they kind of use that sort of thing as a way to build a business case, I guess, or get some momentum going so that they can lobby politicians about it. It's interesting to see, like, a lot of those big tech companies, Amazon, Google, Facebook, they actually spend a lot of money on lobbyists and people applying sort of political pressure, I guess, to try and get laws kind of changed or shaped the way they want them to. I know that...
it's like the end game of capitalism right there.
Like, I know that Facebook, I don't have a lot of detail on it, but I think they've had a bunch of trouble getting their... they have this kind of wireless free internet scheme they want to roll out in India, which has copped a bunch of criticism because it's... I think you don't get all of the internet free. I think you get Facebook and a couple of other partner websites for free. So they've been, I think, lobbying quite hard and trying, you know, they've had people trying to get that scheme up and running, and it's as much of a kind of political battle as it is a, probably more so than it is a technological one.
Well, so often, because tech, I don't know, it seems easy to go around technology,
because
I'm sure if you're somewhere and the only internet you can get is Facebook, you'll be able to find a workaround that'll take you to the rest of the internet.
Yeah, totally. It's sort of interesting to see technology companies kind of beginning to lobby governments a little bit more.
Yeah.
I think, actually, it was interesting, one of the... there was a woman who... She was involved in the kind of, I can't remember exactly which particular Occupy protest, but one of the sort of Occupy Wall Street or similar protests from a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
She's since got a, you know, she was not totally across all of her politics, but she was a big believer in the power of technology to affect social change. She's since got a job at Google. Not quite sure what doing. But I remember reading a sort of op-ed piece about her that she'd written a couple of years ago, which suggested quite seriously that the best way to fix the problems with the US government would be to just hand the whole thing over to Google.
Isn't that the plot line for the second or third, like, the remakes of Star Wars? Palpatine comes in and he's like, guys, I got it sorted. If you hand it over to me, I'll take care of it. And then he releases the clones and then the big battles happen.
Yeah, right. I never saw the second Star Wars, the new episode 2.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Okay.
So I listened to a discussion with Elon Musk and somebody asked him about flying cars. And he made the point that the only reason you need flying cars is so that you can operate in three dimensions rather than two dimensions. And we already have that in the form of tunnels. And it's much cheaper and much more stable and much more idiot-proof for drivers. And I think that there could be more thinking like that around, here's the thing that we think is the solution to a problem that we have, and then we realize that if we put that into essence. Like a Dr. Carl. Somebody rang up and asked Dr. Carl on Triple J about food production in the world, world food production, automation and shit. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Carl took a step back in what I think is one of the more inspiring moments I've heard him talking about stuff, and said, we only need food. We eat food to get energy. And the things that we eat that give us energy got that energy from eating another animal, and that animal ate plants, and those plants changed the energy from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we were running short on traditional food supplies, but we're already at a point where we can genetically engineer things, we genetically engineer photosynthetic ability into humans.
Mm-hmm.
And if we get an hour of sun each day, that's our energy requirements.
Hmm.
And so it changes the entire discussion, because at the moment we're assuming that we need food, but what the discussion should be is that we need
energy. Right.
And then it opens up so many more things. And I wonder if there are things like that that you've come across where, because I had completely bought into the like food is going to be one of our big stumbling blocks as exploding population. But in this scenario, if you boil it down, it's a whole different thought process.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess both of those scenarios, the, you know, the sort of flying cars versus tunnels and food production versus
energy,
are about sort of taking a step back from the problem that you think you have and kind of reframing it
yeah.
as